Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Bring a little sunshine indoors with the exciting new arrivals in store or online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and a very welcome to Liveline. One of the books I was reading on my break, and by the way, thanks again to Katie Hannon for filling in, but one of the books I was reading on my break was a book called Identity. It's a book called Identity by retired Garda, Detective Garda John Sweetman. And I hadn't come across the book. I hadn't heard it mentioned on any radio or television or indeed newspaper. Maybe I'm wrong. But when I was reading it, and this is why I want to give a warning to especially young ears for the next 15 minutes or so. When I was reading it, I was uncannily struck by the bizarre connection or the bizarre similarity between an Irish case which was cracked by brilliant Garda work, including by John Sweetman, in the last few years. And it concerned the case of a man called Liam Finlay. And the reason why I was mesmerised by this particular story is that I was listening to the end of the Holly Willoughby case at the same time. And as you know, a man called Gavin Plum, and you heard it in great detail, had plotted to kidnap and rape Holly Willoughby, who was obviously a very well-known personality, both in the UK and here and further afield, I'm sure. And through brilliant police work, beginning in the United States, they managed to track Gavin Plum down, and he got 16 years in prison. He got a life sentence, a minimum of 16 years for plotting to kidnap and rape. Now, he never actually did it, as you know, but the judge and the judge's verdict is there on YouTube because it was broadcast. The judge described him as an extremely dangerous man. Now, there's a man called Liam Finlay who appears in John Sweetman's book, who I'd never heard of before, a case I'd never heard of before, but the similarities to what happened, Holly Willoughby, and what this man was planning to do are, as I said, uncanny. John Sweetman, good afternoon, John.
How are you doing, Joe? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's an incredible book. It's called Identity. I know it's only recently out, but John, for our listeners, spent 25 years working as a detective guard attached to the Garda Technical Bureau in the Phoenix Park. He qualified as a fingerprint expert, but later, and this is the specific aspect that mesmerised me, later as a security document and handwriting expert. And he spent the bulk of his career examining crime scenes and scenes of crimes exhibits for the purposes of presenting identification, be it fingerprint or otherwise, in the Irish courts. And he was, I know he mentions in the book, in the prologue, it's mentioned that he's a keen artist and has an excellent eye for detail. Well, God knows it came to a great fruition. Tell us, John, first of all, about this. This man is relatively recently been sent to prison for 15 years. Yeah. I suspect most people in the country never heard of Liam Finlay. Tell us how the story unfolded for you, John.
Well, for me, Joe, it started in around 2015. Mm-hmm. By that stage, I was a fully qualified handwriting expert. I'd been in the documents and handwriting section since... Oh, it was 2007, I think it was. So, you know, I'd been there quite a while. I'd examined many, many, many cases from, you know, security documents, threatening letters, question signatures, all that sort of stuff. So I was well into my career as a handwriting expert. But mm-hmm. In 2015, I happened to be examining an anonymous letter, and it consisted of 23 pages of very graphic material in, you know, there was pornographic material attached to mm-hmm. it, but the writing, it was very prolific over 23 pages, and it was all to do with, you know, this the author's obsession with kidnapping, raping and murdering teenage girls, you know. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it went into quite a lot of detail, and he made reference to plans he had in motion and various equipment that he had stored ready for, you know, when he would act out on his threats. But something struck me about the writing when I was examining it, in that it seemed familiar to me. So I went back into the case files, and sure enough, came across a few more cases with the same writing. And then over the course of the next couple of years, 2016 and 2017, further letters came to light. And, you know, I examined all of these letters and was satisfied that they were all the work of the same author.
Okay.
And even going back through the case files within the section, I came across an earlier letter from 2004, which was predated my time in the section, but again, the same author. And what said happened was that these letters were all coming in from separate Garda stations in the Midlands.
Okay.
So, you know, they weren't necessarily being linked to one another because they all had different investigating Gardaí.
Okay.
But, you know, I was able to contact the various members and say, listen, we've got six or seven letters here and it's all the same. It's all written by the same guy. So then they started working together on it, you know.
Also to say that back, and it's fantastic that you went back, but back in 2004, Gardaí had actually come across a hide, a den, in a remote woodland area in the Mead Lachans near Tullamore. And by the way, obviously Liam Findlay we're talking about is currently in prison and was sent to prison in 2019 and originally from Tullamore. But Gardaí had found a hide in 2004 and that's where they came across some letters. But this was a den in the middle, hidden in woods, where it transpired this man was planning to abduct young women and bring. Anyway, so you link the handwriting, and what happened next?
Mm-hmm. Well, over the course of the next, well, as I say, like from 2015 onwards, 2017, as well as the questioned letters coming into me, investigating Gardaí also, you know, identified possible suspects.
Okay.
And provided me with specimens of their handwriting to compare against all of the question material. And, you know, I must have examined 3, 4, 5 different suspects' writings, and none of them were matching the question stuff, you know. And the guards were doing their utmost now to try to identify who could have possibly... The franking kind of code on the envelopes, they were able to identify where some of them were posted, like what post office and maybe at what time period they were sent.
And just to remind listeners, John, the longest letter was 56 pages. It was sent to a school. This contained graphic information about how he planned to abduct, torture, rape and kill 6 named teenagers in the school who were then aged between 15 and 16. This is and this man in the letter, he talked about stalking the school and doing unspeakable things in sight of these. And obviously, they were unaware of this, in sight of these young women. And he said in another part of the letter, he described himself as the beast of all sex beasts. So I presume at that stage, I presume from all along the guard, he said this is a serious, serious threat. So you were looking at the ID on different letters, but you came, insofar as there is any ID, but you came across an ID on a stamp which narrowed it down to one post office. Is that correct?
Yes, the investigating Gardaí had narrowed it down to one particular location for at least some of the letters.
Okay.
And they had like, you know, picked out a couple of individuals from CCTV footage of this post office, but again, their handwriting didn't match. But one of the investigating Gardaí happened to show the footage to a recently retired detective from the area.
Brilliant, brilliant.
And he had spent, you know, the bulk of his career in and around, Tullamore area, that kind of those districts and divisions, and had built up a lot of local knowledge over the years. And he happened to cop a particular guy in the footage.
Okay.
And he said it to the investigating guard that it might be worth looking at that fellow because he's a little bit of an oddball, you know.
Okay.
Sure enough, they followed up on it. He was living at the time with, I think it was his elderly father in a farm, a large farm out in the outskirts of Bullamore. And when they went to the house and carried out a search, they found, you know, a large volume of more handwritten material and pornographic material, like what had been sent in to me to examine. And as soon as they seized some of this stuff and got specimen writing from the suspect, I was able to conclusively say that, yeah, this is the same author, you know. And in the background, like, you know, parallel to what I was doing with any of the question material, colleagues of mine in the Forensic Science Laboratory and in the fingerprint section had also examined the letters and had, you know, identified a common DNA amongst the letters as well as fingerprints. But at the time, the suspect, which turned out to be Liam Findlay, he hadn't come to much attention before, so his DNA wouldn't have been on any databases. Fingerprints went on, but you know, it wasn't for want of trying. But like when he was finally identified and fingerprinted and DNA samples taken from him, they were also identified to him along with the writing.
And at this at this stage, all you could charge Findlay with, because these were all plans and threats and graphic. Because when again, it's a health warning to younger ears and parents. In the search of the suspect's home after this retired garda, this just shows you the importance of the memory. This retired garda went through CCTV footage of this particular post office, and he said, "Well, ABC, I know him, I know her, I know whatever, but that chap, I had my suspicion once or whatever, something," and that led to so the house was raided. The Gardaí, again, health warning. The Gardaí uncovered four tins containing numerous letters similar to those submitted for examination. They also described what they found in court. They described it as a rape kit containing ropes, cable ties, scissors, boxes of condoms, wooden spade, pseudocream, a syringe. And the suspect also had accounts of the Graham Dwyer murder trial and two books on the convicted rapist, Larry Murphy. So what could you charge Findlay with?
You know, like, you can't, you know, it's difficult to, when you come before the court, to, you know, present charges that are going to, you know, going to be approved by the DPP and whatnot. Yeah. But it transpired that because an awful lot of his threats and his graphic descriptions about things that he was going to do or things that he alleged who have done concerned underage girls.
Yeah.
The pornographic material, it doesn't necessarily have to just be, you know, photographs or newspaper clippings or magazines, whatever. It can be written material as well. So he was charged with the possession and distribution of child pornography, as well as he was charged under the Communication Regulations Post Services Act, which, you know, it covers a variety of things, but one particular section in that act pertains to sending material in the post that can be considered grossly obscene, indecent, and menacing, which his material was, certainly, you know.
Sure,
so he was convicted on both charges, and I think he got a combined sentence of 5 years in 2019.
And it's from your book, but I just read out to listeners what Justice Keenan Johnson said about this man, Liam Findlay. And I suspect most people in the country are unaware of this man's name. They know Larry Murphy and they know Gary Graham Dwyer, but they should know Liam Findlay's name, I think, given that he's in prison at the moment. Yeah. He was sent to prison in 2019. When he'd be released, whenever, he'll still be a relatively young man. Like Gavin Plum, it seems he started these activities in his late 20s, early 30s, if we go back to 2000. 2004. But Judge Keenan Johnson, who, remember, heard all the evidence in this case, he described it as one of the most bizarre, extreme and disturbing cases he had ever dealt with, and compared it to something from a Stephen King novel or a horror film. The letters and the preparations the man made to bring his depraved plans to fruition convinced the court that he was a significant danger to society. In May 2019, after nearly 2 years in custody, 48-year-old Liam Findlay was finally sentenced to 15 years in prison. Remember, Gavin Plum got 16, but he 16 minimum, with the final 3 years suspended. So that's 12. He was in 219, so he'll get out. And again, it depends on the what way the prison authorities treat it. But he could get out within 9 years, which would bring him to two in 2028. He was placed, obviously, on the sex offenders register. And a further condition on Findlay's release is that he doesn't reside in the counties of Offaly, Westmeath or Laois for the duration of the suspended sentence. The man was described by a ticking time bomb by the senior investigating Gardaí, and it was an incredible act of Garda crime prevention. But I'm still very conscious. As is ringing, John, as you know, and in many people's ears over the last few weeks, the Holly Willoughby case, and the fact that the judge said he would not read out her victim impact statement but at her request because it had such a devastating effect on her life. Now, when he sent the letters to the schools to these named teenagers, my God, did these young women ever see the letters?
As far as I'm aware, they didn't. They were informed of them down the line. And I think two of the girls did give
victim impact statements,
statements about it. Yeah. But I was only reading on the Gavin Plum thing there myself recently, and the very similar cases, because Gavin Plum had detailed all the equipment that he had stored up in his abduction kit. The only difference being that, the Liam Findlay case, if you want to say it, he was more old school in that he was pen and paper, whereas Gavin Plum was online stuff, but very, very similar.
Also similar in the fact that it was brilliant police work, as it happened in the United States, and that unravelled and revealed. He unravelled and revealed through great police work, and great police work here in Ireland as well. But I remind people, Justice Edward Murray handed down a minimum term of 15 years and 85 days, which this is the Gavin Plum as part of a... Now, I know it's... Did you actually see Liam Findlay?
No, I didn't. And, very often with handwriting cases, although I'm always available to go to court, evidence, a lot of the time with handwriting cases, if the handwriting isn't disputed by, defense or, the suspect,
because
it's not disputed.
Because he pleaded guilty. Now, Findlay is now in prison, but you were struck at the time, as I was in reading it when you said it, because I've been here a long time now, and I'm fairly up to speed, and I hope and should be, it's my job, and what's happening. I'd never heard of this case. Were you surprised by the lack of publicity it got at the time?
I had... as I say, the once I'm finished with a particular case, then I move on to the next one. So I always have plenty of work to keep me going. And I happened to bump into one of the investigating members who headed up the case sometime after. And I said, "What's the story with that?" And he was like, "He told me about, Findlay getting sentenced and whatnot." And even when I went to, do my research for writing my book, Identity, I could not find a single shred about him anywhere, which I found remarkable. But again, the one of the members that I was dealing with, he was so helpful in that he sent me links to the Tullamore Tribune newspaper archives, and it was all all laid out in that, and he was named and all the details of the cases and stuff. But I was amazed that it hadn't gone any further, like it hadn't leaked out to the wider media because of the severity of the stuff, you know.
Okay, stay with us. I'm talking to John Sweetman. John has recently published a book called Identity. It's Murder, Fraud and the Making of a Garda Forensic Expert. And as I said, I was reading it during my break. I came across, it's a fascinating read, but I came across this incredible story of Liam Findlay. And he's in prison at the minute. And it has so many similarities to the Holly Willoughby case, but this man was based in Tullamore and he wrote letters to named teenagers, some of them 52 pages long, threatening to do, again, the Gavin Plum scenario, to do horrific things. And he also had a hide, a den prepared if, God forbid, thankfully the Gardaí caught him, he would ever carry out this horrible, horrible, horrible threats. Now, stay with us, John, because I want to talk to you after the break about how literally a copy of the Daily Star nailed a murderer. Back after this break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
I'm talking to retired Garda Detective John Sweetman. He was in the Forensic Garda Forensic Bureau, but one of his specialities, and they do have them, thankfully, is handwriting. And I know when people think of handwriting in Ireland, they think of who wrote the poison pen letter in Listowel in 1952 or whatever. But this had a much more serious import and thankfully had a much more positive outcome in terms that this man, Liam Findlay, is now serving 16 years in prison. But it is suspended. It's 12 years. And then we've got to work out what will that actually mean, because he went into prison at 219. He'll be back out in this decade, obviously, and he will still be a relatively young man. Now, can I ask you, John, please, about the case of Raymond Salinger? And the reason I remember this is because I think I reported it at the time for 5-7 Live. This was a murder up in a pub in New Street in the Liberties in Dublin. Tell us about how the Daily Star newspaper, literally a copy of the Daily Star, helped you solve that crime.
It was 2003. Yeah. And I had only recently been fully qualified as a fingerprint expert. It takes a considerable time, up to 5 years of training and external courses over in the UK, and that before you're allowed off the leash on your own to crime scenes and like that. So in 2003, as you were saying, there was a gentleman called Raymond Salinger shot dead in Farrell's public house on New Street, and it transpired that Raymond Salinger, he'd only recently come back from the UK, having been away since, mm-hmm. I think it was back in the late 80s, because Christy Kinahan had been convicted of possession and distribution of drugs in around 1986. But Kinahan had, for some reason or other, blamed Salinger for, providing information on him, which wasn't the case. Salinger didn't have anything to do with it. But nevertheless, he was a marked man and had only recently come back to Ireland because his wife was ill. So he was sitting drinking pints in Farrell's, and two gunmen came in and shot him, mm-hmm. and he subsequently died. So as is the case with any serious crime like murder or suspicious deaths, a technical bureau team was put together and sent out to assist the investigating Gardaí. So that would be, a fingerprint person, which was me. Then you'd have ballistics experts, a mapper and a photographer.
Okay.
So we went and examined the scene. There wasn't really much in the way of evidential value for me anyway as a fingerprint expert there, because the gunman had
just come in, had carried out the deed, and were gone and away in a car. So physical evidence of any importance was kind of lacking. Like, I mean, I could have examined the entire pub and gotten fingerprints off of everything, pint glasses and stuff, but nothing that would have...
Yeah, but I know, I noticed, well, give yourself more credit there, John, and indeed, I know you're very keen in right throughout your book to give all the various Gardaí and the various elements of the Gardaí credit, but one of the things you did, which I would never have thought of, you actually took fingerprints from the outside of the windows of the pub, because you said to yourself, maybe there was a lookout, maybe he went up to the window, put his hand in and had a look in. So that was smart thinking, but unfortunately didn't get you anywhere, but it was smart thinking.
No, like, I mean, as I say, you pick up a lot from other people that you're working with over the years that have had so many years experience, as well as, you know, the Gardaí on the ground that are dealing with it. So there's no suggestion too outlandish if it might be of benefit. Okay. So, but unfortunately, we examined the windows and stuff and didn't get anything. There was nothing on the bullets. There was no fingerprints on the bullet cases or anything like that. But it wasn't until, I think it was 2 or 3 days later, that the getaway car that was purported to have been used in the killing was located, and an attempt had been made to torch it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was a stroke of luck for us, in that whoever had set fire to it had thrown some accelerant petrol inside the car, had lit some newspapers, and had walked away. But they had shut the doors and had left the windows up, so the fire quickly ran out of oxygen and extinguished itself. So the car was pretty much intact, with only, you know, a little bit of smoke damage inside. So myself and a few other bureau members went down to the lockup in the old Kevin Street Garda station to examine the car, and I did all the fingerprinting of the, you know, the outside of it, and took the number plates, which, you know, turned out to be false plates and whatnot. But as well as that, I took the petrol canister and what remained of the scrunched up newspaper that they tried to burn the car out with. And I wasn't having any luck with, you know, the examination of the exterior of the car or the number plates or anything like that. But I was banking on the newspaper having something for me, because newspaper is you know, can be very good at retaining fingerprints. And because it's porous, and because, you know, fingerprints for the most part are made in sweat, and, you know, combination sweat and salts and amino acids and stuff like that. So they soak into the paper, and using a wet process and a special chemical called ninhydrin, it can be possible then to develop any marks that may have been left on newspaper or paper, you know. And sure enough, I examined the newspaper, and some really, you know, clear fingerprints developed on it. And as is the norm when you examine and develop finger marks, well, back then, everything was, it still hadn't gone digital. So I got the Garda photographer to photograph the finger marks, so I could scan them into the automated fingerprint identification system.
And one of the reasons you went after the newspaper was you presumed that this whoever was setting the car on fire lit, obviously, when he was getting the petrol can, he would have been wearing gloves, but when he got to the act of lighting the newspaper, he would have presumed that the whole newspaper would disappear in the conflagration. So he would have taken he could have taken off his gloves, which was your hunch. He took off his gloves and he threw in the Daily Star burning, thinking it would go up with the car. But he didn't. He forgot the whole thing about oxygen. You went after the fingerprint, and that's where you found the fingerprints on the Daily Star.
Yeah, and It was a stroke of luck as well that it happened to be on a newspaper, because I've often been asked, and fingerprint experts are asked about aging a finger mark, like saying how long is something there. And, you know, so a suspect might say, well, you know, I could have put that on, you know, I could have handled that at any time or whatever. But on an object like a newspaper, that fingerprint couldn't have been made at any time before the date of that's on the newspaper. Okay, you know,
so it,
it narrows down the window. And as I say, I put the mark in for search on the fingerprint system. Now, it doesn't identify stuff by itself. It's just an aid, you know, it speeds up the process, but it narrows it down to, you know, however many respondents it thinks it's closest to, but it's still up to the fingerprint expert to make the identification. And, you know, I subsequently was able to identify a nice, clear finger mark on the newspaper as belonging to a gentleman called Martin Servi. And it was one of the very few times then in my career that I was called to actually present the fingerprint evidence in an interview situation, that when the guards had Mr. Servi in for questioning. As a matter of fact, I think it's the only time I was ever called to do that, because they were of the mind that the best way to put this information to him is, you know, by the expert themselves, whatever, you know. And so I went down to Kevin Street and went into the interview room and put it to Mr. Servi. And of course, as was throughout the whole of time of detention, he had nothing to say, no comment, whatever, you know. And so that was kind of the end of my involvement with it. Okay. But it transpired then afterwards, like, obviously the investigating guard, he had other, you know, supportive evidence and all that, and charged Martin Servi in relation to the Raymond Salinger murder. But the DPP came back with, you know, it did not recommend to proceed with the prosecution for whatever reason. But and this was, like, as I say, this was in the early 2000s, long before the Kinahan Hutch thing kicked off. But, you know, the murder of Raymond Salinger was thought to be probably one of the earliest killings attributed to the Kinahans. And Mr. Servi, Martin Servi, died a few years later from, I think it was a heart attack or something. He was over in Amsterdam. So the case remains unsolved. And nobody has been brought before the courts for it. But for me, it was a great confidence boost, in that was my first murder murder scene that I went to as a newly a newly minted fingerprint expert, and to get an ident in a murder case on your first time out was it was great for me. You know, it really boosted my confidence. Even though it didn't get to the courts and there was no successful conviction, it's still, to me, you know, it's still an identification in a serious crime. So it was a great experience for me.
And Martin Servi died in the Netherlands in 2016 from a suspected heart attack. And one of the points you make in the book is that the murder of Raymond Salinger, despite all the evidence, remains unsolved. But people are confident about the name man. But you say his violent end was one of the earliest deaths attributed to the Kinahan cartel. It helped solidify the gang's reputation for ruthless violence and their long memory. Because remember, Raymond Salinger, God rest him, had been basically went on, disappeared from Ireland for many, many years. But it solidified the Kinahan gang's reputation. This is when the gang were in their nascence, so to speak. It helped solidify the gang's reputation for ruthless violence and their long memory for vengeance upon anyone who they perceived had wronged them. Finally, after the break, John, I want to point this out to people before I say it. One of the really strong elements of your book is the effect, and was something we forget, the effect that these crimes can have on the investigating Gardaí. And it's one of the cases you were part of, the major investigation, and you talk about the effect it had on you, is that of Alan Hawes, who murdered his wife, his three young children, Liam, Niall, and Ryan, in 2016, and they were discovered by their granny and Clodagh's mother, Mary Call. But you talk about the horror of that crime and the effect it had on everyone around you. And we'll talk to you about that after this break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
I'm talking about a book, Identity. It was written by retired Detective Garda John Sweetman. It's just been published by Hachette, and John, as you've heard, has, like so many Gardaí, dealt with very, very harrowing cases. But it's his speciality of fingerprints and indeed handwriting that mesmerised me when I was reading it there in the last few weeks. Now, the horrible story of Alan Hawes, and again, people will remember this, unfortunately, because of the fact that this man, Alan Hawes, who worked in a school, inexplicably, it seems, murdered his wife, Clodagh, and his three young boys, Liam, Niall and Ryan, in the family home. Now, you say in the chapter you write on this, John, that when you examined Alan Hawes' handwriting, his handwriting, you began to get a picture of the man.
Again, it's not really the role of a handwriting expert to, mm-hmm. you know, try to do any psychological assessment of an author. And I've often been asked, as I was at the inquest into the Hawes case, I was asked, like, was there any indications in his writing of, you know, his state of mind and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't in this, that as a handwriting expert, you're concerned with the construction of the writing, okay. not so much the content of what has been written, which is obviously important to the investigating Gardaí, but for the handwriting examiner, it's not, you know, a paramount importance, but you can't but help absorb it because you have to continually go over the written material when you're carrying out your examinations. Okay. But in my mind, you know, again, it wasn't something that was going to be presented as evidence or anything like that. But in my mind, I started to get some kind of feeling as to perhaps what kind of thought processes that went through Alan Hawes' mind. Now, again, there was nothing in the written material that he left at the scene, having killed his family, to explain why he'd done it. There was no smoking gun, as you might call it. He did try to rationalise his actions and this, that, and the other, but there was no, you know, eureka, this is why he'd done it. But to me, the writing was, and I had plenty of it. I had the writing that he'd left at the scene, some of which had been written presumably after he had carried out the attacks, because there was some blood staining on them. But I also had plenty of specimen handwriting from his, you know, his place of work, the school, mm-hmm. and whatnot. And what struck me was that all of the writing was so, you know, neat and concise and fluent, no kind of sign of being under pressure or stress. Or sometimes, mm-hmm. if a writer is under extreme emotional duress, or maybe under the influence of an intoxicant or alcohol or drugs, you would see some kind of effect in the writing. But there was nothing in throughout the question material that he had left behind, and you know, the writing was really concise and neat and perfectly laid out. And again, I don't go into the content of wrote, but some of the specimen writing which I had been provided, you know, it struck me that he was a person that was extremely obsessed with detail and had a, you know, maybe had a mindset that things had to be a certain way, you know, there was no margin for, you know, error or whatever. Like, and I think I mentioned it in the book that one of the pieces of specimen writing referred to, I think it was kids in the school toilets leaving drops of water on the sink. You know, really what a lot of us would think are pedantic details, but, you know, it kind of gave me anyway, it gave me a feeling that this was somebody that was wound fairly tightly. And, you know, if things weren't going his way or what he perceived to be the correct way things should be, then he might unravel, you know. Plus, like, I mean, I myself, and I've mentioned it in the book as well, I'm a stickler for detail and I'm a perfectionist in a lot of what I do. But it struck me as if his level of pedantic, whatever, it was on a different, you know, a different stratosphere altogether. And
I have the book here in front of me. There was also a letter regarding drops of water in and around the school toilet sinks and the importance of keeping one's hands over the sink and shaking off excess drops carefully. I began to build a picture of a man who was perhaps obsessed with details and perfection, always thinking about how his actions would be perceived in the community. He was someone who planned every minute detail of whatever he was involved in, including murder. I got the impression, though he did murder his family, I got the impression that he was someone who was wound too tightly. The slightest slip up, as you say, and everything would unravel. But how did you prove, John, that some of Alan Hall's letters were written after he had murdered his family?
Well, again, it wasn't something that was, you know, that was going to be given in evidence. Yeah. You know, I'm only there as a fingerprint or as a handwriting expert to prove authorship. And that's it, really, you know. But, you know, I had noted it that, you know, there was blood on the letters. And, you know, it seemed to me that they had, at least some of them had to have been written after he'd carried out the attacks, you know. But again, I was called to give evidence of just to prove the letters in the inquest.
Yeah.
And that was my connection to it. But, you know, it did stick with me because it was such a high profile and such a terrible crime. And when I went to the inquest and I had to listen to my colleagues in the bureau give their evidence of what they were greeted with at the scene, what the initial Gardaí that first came to the scene, along with poor Mary Call, Clodagh's mam, you know, their thing. So it really struck home to me that these were real people. This was a real family that was completely wiped out. And, you know, it did stick with me.
And you do talk about the effect, the two Gardaí, and they're named in the book, who actually arrived at the house. Mary Call, Clodagh's mother, and obviously the grandmother, Mary, and then her daughter, who'd be Clodagh's sister, Jacqueline. And you say, you saw them in the coroner's court, and you looked over at Mary and her daughter, Jacqueline, on your way out. I wanted to stop and say something to them, to offer my words of comfort, but this would have interrupted the proceedings. And the following day at the inquest, Mary Call summed up what everyone felt. There are no words to describe the upset that befell our family. It's unimaginable what you have had to endure. The foreman of the jury, which comprised six women and one man, fought back emotion as he read out the findings: four counts of unlawful killing and one count of suicide. And just think it's important that people are reminded of this. Important that people, if they do find themselves in distress or under pressure, that they do seek professional help. And we'll be putting up, as per usual, the numbers, and they are on the RTÉ website, of people who do feel under pressure, even about small items. But it's a remarkable insight. Now, I know when people hear of crime books, they think of William's great books. They think of Garda Tom Conley. They think of John O'Brien, and the loads of recent books: Ronan McGreevy, his book, Nicola Tallon's books. There's your book is different in that. There's a lot of detail in it, and remember, it is about forensics. And it is about handwriting, but still it is fascinating. How long did it, why did you write it, John?
Well, as I say, I retired, Joe, at the end of September last year. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty much, you know, pretty much around the same time that I just sat down and put pen to paper. And I'd always wanted to write and, you know, had started different bits and pieces and never went anywhere. But then I said to myself, well, I'm finished now in the Guards. That's 30 years of my life.
Yeah.
I think I was, you know, I had a pretty interesting career in that I had the fingerprint aspect and later the handwriting, and might have a good story to tell. And you know, I had read different true crime books and books by other Garda members. Mostly they were from an investigative angle. And I didn't think there was anything out there that kind of dealt with the work that I was involved in. And you know, because I found it fascinating and I was in it for 25 years doing it, I thought, geez, maybe some readers might find it fascinating.
I tell you why I didn't. I learned a lot from it, and also the whole thing that I think we forget too often is the Gardaí investigating. These are humans like ourselves, and the impact of coming across. I think at one stage, it's not in front of me, but at one stage you mentioned the smell of going into a dead house where there's somebody, you could recognise that smell the minute you open the door, that there's someone dead.
Anybody that's had to deal with those situations, it becomes, you know, it's a smell you don't forget, you know. Certainly it's unique smell altogether.
And you were able, in fairness, you were able to prove, and the Gardaí were able to prove on a lot of occasions where people had been found deceased and deceased for a certain period in a home, you were able to allay the fears of their family or whatever, that the person had been unlawfully killed, by being able to prove that they had died of natural causes. So thanks indeed. And again, I'm in your story, and I know you mentioned them, Garda Aisling Walsh and Garda Alan Radcliffe, who arrived with Mary Call that day because Alan Hawes had put a note on the door, written a note on the door: please don't come in, please call the Gardaí. That's the note that met Mary Call, that incredible woman, as she arrived at the door that day and didn't know what was going to, as she said, what was going to befall her and her remaining family. The book is called Identity. It's called Murder, Fraud and the Making of a Garda Forensic Expert. It's by John Sweetman. It's in Hachette, and I presume also, I always say it, in your local library or whatever. I think it's a fascinating read on so many levels, especially on the level of us all having empathy for the men and women of the Garda Síochána, and the so many different elements of the Garda Síochána that we sometimes forget. Did you ever have to deal with poison pen letters, John? I'm thinking of that incredible movie recently with Olivia Colman and Jesse Buckley. Poison, I think it was called Poison. Have you ever had to, or do they still exist, given that the art of handwriting is gone?
Well, the art of handwriting is kind of dying out, certainly among the younger generation, but many times over the years you'd get letters that were kind of like, you know, poison pen letters, or nothing that was threatening or anything like that, but, you know, malicious, or trying to stir up bad rumours
that movie was called Wicked Little Letters, and it says it says it all about that type of letter. Now Finlay's letters and threats and the building of a den were on a completely different level. John Sweetman, thank you indeed, and as I say, the book is called Identity, and I'll tweet the details during the break. John Sweetman, thank you for your service. Joe at RTE.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
In fairness, we found one report of the case of Liam Findlay, and unsurprisingly, it's in the Sunday World, who still are doing incredible work in exposing crime and criminals. And it's written by Eamon Dillon, and the same applies to Eamon, still doing incredible work and has been for years. And it was billed an exclusive by Eamon Dillon on June the 2nd, 2019. And the headline is, he was he says, I'm the beast of all sex beasts. And he targeted schoolgirls and had a torture chamber. But that was written by Eamon Dillon in 2019. And as I say, Findlay is still in prison, thanks to fantastic Garda work. He never brought. I cannot imagine the impact those horrific 53-page pornographic letters addressed to named young women, the effect that could have on them if they were to read them. And obviously they heard about them in court. They had to. And thankfully they were never identified. Gary O'Reilly. Gary, a different issue. Summertime. You wanted to send to go on a holiday at a short notice, last minute, so to speak. What happened?
Definitely a bit of a different issue, Joe.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
What happened? Three young kids, and we wanted to just have a staycation instead of packing them onto, you know, a plane and all that sort of crack. So we went down to Enniscrone and actually found a hotel that advertises like family rooms if you need, you know, separate space for the kids and whatnot.
Okay.
So it looked good, you know, great reviews. Went down, and generally speaking, I've like stayed in a lot of hotels, never really complained, but this was kind of faulty towers bad over the weekend just gone, and obviously mid-July, you know, it was pricey. So I suppose what I would say is I know people who've stayed there, they've had a great time, so we're probably a bit unfortunate, but
okay. It was in the very popular spot of Enniscrone, and you wanted room only for your family. Three children under four, and the parents, obviously, for two nights. How much were you charged?
I think it was 500.
Okay. And it was in...
But
did you think you were staying at the Ocean Sands Hotel, or were you aware that you were staying in a cottage connected to the Ocean Sands, not physically?
Yeah, that's where it was a bit weird. So got there, went into the hotel, actually paid on arrival, and they gave me an envelope with keys and directions for a house kind of down the village. So it wasn't, I had assumed it was, because they do have accommodation on site, like apartments, which I pulled up outside, but then it wasn't them, they were full. So we kind of got down to a bit of a student house type accommodation with broken telly, broken shower, broken everything. And it was just a bit dirty. And to be honest, we got down late, so we just kind of got on with it. And I think it was that evening, there was no Wi-Fi either, no telly. So we needed to entertain the kids somehow, and I went up to reception. They couldn't get the Wi-Fi, and there was no manager. So your one that was there, she was actually lovely. She was like, look, that sounds terrible, send us an email. So I sent them an email just explaining this wasn't what we had, you know, signed up for. To be honest, we cracked on with the holiday, and it was the email response that is probably what has made me want to, you know, get in touch.
Okay.
So my assumption was, you know, a manager comes in on Monday and is a bit horrified with pictures of, you know, broken appliances and whatnot. And I think the initial response was kind of along the lines of tough. You know, you need to take it up directly with the other accommodation. We're just acting as intermediaries.
Okay.
Which I didn't know, obviously, and I didn't even know where to, you know, to where to get in touch with.
Okay. Because you had paid the Ocean Sands Hotel, I presume.
Yeah, so like booking confirmation, payment on the bank is all Ocean Sands, yeah. So
and then they said it has nothing to do with us.
I think the tone, well, I think I sent in the email, but it was, what would you like us to pass on to the property? You know, we nothing to do with us. And there was no comment on, you know, there wasn't even a sorry for your experience type tone. It was just, it's your fault, you've misunderstood, and take it up with them.
Mm-hmm. And by the way,
so that probably annoyed me more than that.
Okay. Have you got your money back?
So that's it. You know, I was obviously quite annoyed in that, and I responded
Just to do yourself justice, because you do say, for example, the microwave couldn't heat the baby's bottle. The place was dirty, the showers were dirty, the bathing facility, the water, you say, was undrinkable.
Great, but obviously we were on a holiday and we didn't want it to, you know, I didn't want to get, you know, too bent out of shape over it. And, you know, generally I want to be reasonable, so I just brought it up to them and waited for the manager to get in touch. But I think it was the tone of the email that surprised me more than Anton. Mm-hmm. And then I hadn't heard Anton back. So I think the way I was feeling was they don't care. They have our money and they're fobbing us off. Now, to be clear, they've since actually, now that I'm online, they've been in touch. The general manager has, you know, been to bring balance, has been really, okay. really nice, very okay. apologetic.
Okay.
You know, she was obviously misinformed as what happened.
Where's the money? And follow the money, Gary. Where's the money?
Well, I'll keep an eye on the account.
If they admit that, they say that the facility that they put you in was the first time they ever used it. Is that correct?
I don't know if they've used it before or
yeah.
not.
They say you're 100% right in your claims. That's brilliant. We failed Gary and his family. We sent the wrong, it's gone off my screen. We sent the wrong email or something. But there's no mention. The only thing I want to read in those statements is, and I'm not reading out a big statement from a hotel, except where it finishes and says, we've reimbursed Gary, because it's saying any sensible person looking at that says the money should be reimbursed or some gesture made.
No, and to be fair, they will. From what I've said, they will. So she did ring me, and what I said, you know, both on the day and to her was, I'm not complaining to get any sort of monetary gain. I was just a bit annoyed by the email. So she did say that they'll make it right, and I'm sure we'll figure that out. But yeah, definitely up until that point, it was not great.
Okay. Now here we have it now. The hotel have said you will get a full refund. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. And so, I think
that the main thing, and sorry if I can just say, is like, thanks to you and the team has probably made that happen quicker. And, you know, I'm not, you know, would like to believe that they would have done it, you know, without
yeah,
you. But,
sure they would, yeah.
You know, I would just say, if you're running a hotel, you don't need Joe or Twitter to hold people to account. Yeah. I think when you complain about that, it should probably be looked into.
Okay, and I'm here every single day until the end of next June at this rate, gladly. And I say to people again, we're here every single day. And if you do go away, please take our email, which is joe@rte.ie. Joe. And the main reason I want people to talk about these issues is that it will warn other people. I'm thinking of people going to be pickpocketed in Barcelona, to be scammed in Venice or whatever with three card tricks. Just, it stops people. I know people say, I've lost the money and I'm upset and I feel stupid. That's not your case. I feel stupid. But I say to people, please tell us so we can tell our listeners and we can make sure that they're not pickpocketed, that they're not robbed, that they're not scammed, be it online or in person, which apparently is the big thing now when you go abroad. But Gary, off you go. As you say, the hotel itself has a very good reputation, so please God that can be sorted out as well. They say the accommodation, as you know, wasn't directly associated physically with the hotel. But anyway, Gary, enjoy whatever break you have left, and especially with three children under four.
Yeah, thanks. I'll ring you tomorrow to talk about Ryanair.
What are you laughing at? Three children under four. You're blessed.
I know, yeah. Lucky man.
What's their names? Just give me their names. I don't know.
We have, do you know what? I'm sure Granny and Grandad will be ringing me now in a minute. Bonnie, Bo and Ollie.
Oh, beautiful. Bonnie, Bo and Ollie.
Yeah.
I love the name Bo. I'm trying to write a book at the minute, and the main character in it is called Beauregard. His name is Bo, actually. But anyway, and it's supposed to be a crime novel. It'll be a crime if it's ever published, I can tell you. But the main character is called Bo. So I'm glad to hear there's actually young people around called Bo. Gary O'Reilly, good to meet them all. Good. Joe@rte.ie. Claire Minnock, come on, warn people. Help people. A lot of people want to go to Kilmainham Jail. They regard it as their... it's a very, very busy spot. Very hard to get tickets. Claire, what happened in your case?
Hi, Joe. How are you? Yeah.
Good, thanks.
So what happened to me was, I've been dying to go for ages. I've heard people talking about it. And sometimes when it's on your doorstep, you don't get to see these things. But basically, I went online to book tickets several times before and could never get them.
Okay.
We're a family of five. So myself, the husband, the three kids. And I went to go on there a couple of weeks ago, and I've been on the website several times before, clicked in, Googled Kilmainham Jail tickets.
Right.
And up came the website, and every day in July was free. So I thought, okay, I'll book the 15th, which is Monday gone. and it kept telling me that it's Sunday 15th. And my husband was sitting beside me and I said, am I doing something wrong here? He said, try and book the Tuesday. And I pressed on the Tuesday and it told me again that it was Sunday.
Okay.
So I said, oh, there's some problem with this. I'll just email them. So I emailed them and straight away, 10 minutes later, the phone rang and it was a very nice man from the OPW. And he said, did you put in your credit card details? And I said, no. I said, I didn't even get that far. And he said, good.
Thank God.
He said, it's a total scam. And he said, they're operating from wherever, somewhere.
So somebody has gone to the trouble of setting up a scam site to sell tickets for the visitor experience. I know it's a brilliant experience. The visitor experience to Kilmainham Jail in Dublin because the demand is such that they know they can fish people. They can get people in quickly. Absolutely. And luckily enough. So
Joe, I've been on the website so many times before that, you know, I knew what it should look like. It looked exactly right. Everything was right. Even the email to tell them there was a problem was the right email link. But it was obviously something in the domain name at the top. I didn't look at it. You know, I didn't look at that. But it was the wrong website. But another lady had been on to the OPW that morning, a hotelier somewhere in Dublin, and she had a client in who had lost €1,000. So with the same scam. So it's kind of just a warning for visitors, especially tourists, I suppose, you know, just to check that they don't get scammed from the comfort of their hotel room. And you know, you don't have to go to Las Ramblas.
To get scammed, exactly. And I'm conscious of, by the way, of another new visitor reopening today in Dublin. It's the O'Connell Monument in Glasnevin Cemetery, and it's a fantastic, fantastic. It's been closed for a number of years, mainly because it was so old. That's my understanding. But now you can go inside. I've been inside on the ground floor with the late great Shane McElmarsh, but we couldn't go up the stairs, so to speak, because I wasn't safe at the time. But now I see today that's another staycation location. And there are many, maybe there's lots of them in the country that we don't know about. Well, now is your chance over the next few days if you want to tell us about your staycation locations. Okay, when are you going?
We're actually supposed to go now on this Thursday.
Oh, great.
So I'm really looking forward to it now. I can't wait. And actually, Glasnevin Cemetery is another place that I'd like to go this summer too.
Ah.
On the summer list, because I haven't been either. But it's too near you sometimes, Joe. You don't go to these
it's
things.
It's a very
you know?
Popular place, Claire. People are dying to get into it.
Yeah. Very good, Joe. I like this, yeah.
And they're the last people that will let you down. You know that in Glasnevin.
Yeah, oh,
by the way, another book I read on my holidays was by Warren Farrell, who's written a book about Glasnevin. And it's a as I say, 1 million Dead is a great documentary series made with Shane McElmarsh. And then Warren and Shane wrote a number of books about Glasnevin. But Warren, who's a tour guide there, one of the great tour guides in Glasnevin, he has written a book about the basically who's buried there and who's the various some good too. Loads of places. If you know any other places that people should visit, please let us know. Last commercial break at 2:53.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Joe at rt.ie. I mentioned Daniel O'Connell and the fact that today the Daniel O'Connell Tower in Glasnevin is reopening to visitors. And I did not know this, but John Crotty is about to tell us. Where did Daniel O'Connell leave his heart, John?
Yeah, an extraordinary story, Joe. Daniel O'Connell asked that he could go, his heart be sent to Rome when he passed away. Okay. And indeed, the heart was taken there initially.
And where's his body?
So his body was returned to Glasnevin Cemetery.
Okay,
and buried there in a fabulous mausoleum. He asked that his soul go to heaven, and no doubt his wishes were honoured. He was a great man. But his heart, he wanted to go to Rome, for he was on a pilgrimage at the time.
So Daniel O'Connell specified that his body should go back to Glasnevin, but his heart, why did he want his heart to go somewhere else?
You know, he was a deeply religious man in later life, and he was doing a pilgrimage to Rome at the time. He wanted it to be his last action to go to what he considered one of the holiest places in the world.
Okay,
so he loved the idea that he'd be there.
So where do you his heart has gone missing, basically. And where do you believe his heart is now, John?
Well, you know, it's a sad story that when the heart was arrived there, in 1927, they went to move it and they discovered the heart was missing. Now, there's a couple of things that could have happened, but sadly, theft has to be high on the agenda, Joe. They did make a fabulous silver cask that the heart is kept in. So it's entirely possible that the heart was stolen for that reason, for the silver cask. Now, equally, though, there could be a good end to the story, because the bank that was next door was moving into area owned by the church, and it's possible that it's still in the vaults of the church also.
An Italian bank, yes.
Where's
Morris O'Connell, I'm conscious of time here. Morris O'Connell is a direct descendant of the Liberator, great-great-great-grandnephew of Daniel O'Connell. Did you know the story of your great-great-great-great-uncle's heart, Morris?
I did, Joe. Good afternoon, anyway. I wonder if the bank will let us in to root around a bit to try and find the casket. Maybe not. But I went to the Irish College back in about just before the pandemic to have a look at. There's a magnificent plaque that was placed in front of the of where they had the heart originally, and that was donated by Bianconi, who was the guy with the stagecoaches, who was Daniel O'Connell's son-in-law, and the plaque is there, but the heart isn't. And I think they must have been stolen. It was a rather beautiful looking casket by the looks of things. And you just hope that the heart wasn't thrown to the dogs or something. But maybe it'll be in the bank, hopefully.
Okay. Well, as I say, it's the book I was referring to in about the most recent book about Glasnevin is written by Warren Farrell, and I think it's called As Once Was I, which is a very famous quote. Thanks indeed. I'm running out of time. Do you think
Glasnevin tour was well worth doing? It's a fantastic,
place.
It's one of the great things that Dan did in his lifetime, and we try and honour him with our Liberator Irish whiskey. So it's well worth looking at.
Okay, and Warren Farrell, who's a tour guide, his book is called So Once Was I. Well done, John Forn. John Crotty, I know you're a historian, and will you continue to search for Dan's heart?
Absolutely. You know, I think it's well worth a letter to the relevant authorities.
Okay. Have you checked San Francisco?
No.
Most people seem to have left their heart. By the way, that quote was, "So once was I, remember now as you go by, as you are now, so once was I, and as I am now, so you shall be. So prepare for death and follow me." That's not an introduction to Ray D'Arcy, but he is next. And the producer today was Sian O'Gorman.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Summer's here. Spruce up your bedroom for less with our sizzling summer sale offers at harrycurry.com.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815 or send your WhatsApp voice notes to 087 484 8888.